The Constitution will be up on the J Drive shortly, so everybody can take a look at that. Point system we're working on, we'll get that on the J Drive too.
Alright, this year we're definitely enforcing the point system, and it's going to determine whether you go to convention or not. So pay attention to that. We're offering tutoring at the library from Sunday through Thursdays, 8 to 10. If you want a tutor or you need help with that, any subject, I'll just go, and Steve Lee has more information.
Dues, if you remember last year, you're automatically a member for this year, and dues are $13. You can pay those to Shan Shan ASAP. And then, if you're not a member and you came, thanks for coming. We're going to have invitations going out shortly after we get report cards, so we look forward to having you. We're going to go ahead and get started. Our speaker today is Dr. Joseph Bocconi. If you haven't already figured it out, he's my dad. He's a professor at Mississippi State University right now. He's also worked for the government. He's worked for Texas Instruments, the calculator people, and a bunch of little jobs in between. So he's going to talk about how we use math to decipher languages. So please pay attention, and afterwards we'll have refreshments.
Okay.
It's
well, welcome. I always enjoy coming here and talking to this group. So hopefully what I'll tell you about today you'll find somewhat interesting. I will ask, I learned a long time ago in teaching that it's important to keep people's attention by giving away free things. So I've got three things here. And at various points in the presentation, I'll ask some questions, and whoever answers them right first will get their choice. So, pay attention. And there we go.
No, he's going to come back on.
Yeah.
So, when I always tell my colleagues when I do these talks, this is probably the hardest talk I have to give because you're a very demanding audience and I have to keep your attention or I'm going to lose you pretty quickly. So we came up with this title, Can You Say Hamburger in 6,000 Languages? And I'll hopefully by the end of this talk you'll appreciate how important language is and how diverse the world's become. And so that's kind of annoying there sitting right in the middle. But So those two pictures on to the side of the main shot are actually pictures that display the distribution of languages around the world. And I'd like to begin by talking about that general issue and how that influences the way we view the world. And then we'll also talk a little bit about how we use the internet to learn more about what's going on in the world. So I think, is this wireless mouse working?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Did you reset the lamp timer?
I tried to. Hopefully
we'll
do it.
Okay, I don't think this guy's working.
You have to hold the button down on the bottom.
We can just watch the actual
You have to hold the button down on the bottom and then click. It should work.
Turn the light off.
Anyway, I'll just use the keyboard.
Dim the light.
I'll use the mouse, that'll be fine. Okay, so what is the challenge these days? Well, I thought I'd go through a little bit of history on how we got to the point we're at today. So in post-World War II era, global politics were dominated by a handful of languages. When I was your age and told when you need to go to college, you have to take some kind of language requirement. Well, in my day, the big language was Russian. They wanted us to go to college and learn Russian, and I wasn't too thrilled about that. So I actually had signed up to take Chinese, which back then, this was 1975, was not high on people's lists, but I thought, well, if I'm going to have to take a language, I should learn something interesting. But in those days, we were being told, learn Russian, because you have to understand what Russian mathematicians are writing about in their papers and all this. And the geopolitical map was pretty clearly split along the lines of democracy, and third world countries were not really very important, so nobody learned about learning Vietnamese or what languages were spoken in the Philippines. Mostly people were worried about the Romance languages and things like that. In the post-1960s, there was a lot of anti-government sentiment, and people were more concerned actually about industrial issues. Big Brother was watching us. People were worried about how companies were spying on us and those kinds of things. And that sort of culminated with a movie, one of my favorite movies called The Conversation, which was done in the 70s, which is about this whole world of industrial espionage. So I actually hope there were going to be more teachers in the room so I could ask a question about this movie. But so my first question is, I'm sure most of you, how many people have actually seen this movie? I'm guessing none of this generation has seen this movie. Well, you're missing a really important. Did you ever see this movie? No? Oh. Well, that shoots my first question. But I'll maybe leave that as a homework assignment. There was a young actor in that movie who's since become a very, very famous actor. And actually, I think he did his best acting in that movie. It was one of his first movies, and he had a small role in that movie. Well, actually, he was a co-star in that movie. But it was a movie about industrial espionage, and it revolved around the fact that... Gene Hackman plays somebody who does essentially electronic eavesdropping, and in those days that was done with placing microphones in public places and trying to focus on the sounds and things. And the premise of the movie is they hear this little clip that they think something's going to happen, and throughout the movie you realize what they heard was what they thought they heard was actually wrong, and it was a whole. And so they end up going through that kind of a convoluted thing. And that's not unlike what happens in the intelligence business, and that's not unlike what happens when people are trying to monitor what's going on in the world. But in those days, we were worried mostly about English, maybe a little bit of Russian, and then French and German. Well, on September 11th, of course, the world changed in 2001, and suddenly people were running around trying to understand all these new languages, what were considered new languages at the time, languages like Arabic and such. In recent years, Mandarin Chinese has actually become the world's most common language. There have been a number of books published in recent years that talk about how English is no longer going to be the dominant language in the world. And in fact, English will probably be third or fourth in the world by the year 2050. Now, English is still important economically and politically, but in terms of the common languages being spoken, there's more people speaking Mandarin Chinese than any other language in the world. I think the second-ranked language is Hindi, and the third-ranked language, I think, is Arabic. And there are a lot of dialects and variants of these languages, so it's a little bit hard to talk about what is a language these days because there's so many dialects and things. But what's become really different after 9/11 is that the need to understand less common languages are important, because when, for example, something happens in the world in a third world country, most of the information is being exchanged in the native language of that country. And that's really one of the things that's changed. So today, even though there are a few languages which dominate commerce throughout the world, when you want to actually understand politics and understand world events, you need to be fluent in these less common languages. So let's...
Suratan na kiti Lizard Fish Talo at Yahoo.com may panggap ti amin ngay bagala iti tarib ng awag at Lizard Fish Talo.
So, what did you hear?
Arabic.
I hear Arabic.
That's a good guess. Unfortunately, it's not Arabic.
Hindi.
No.
Is that Urdu?
Not Urdu.
Telugu.
So no one, fortunately, I don't think you put the slides online, right? Good. So my second question was going to be, what's that language? But I didn't expect you to answer that. My real question is, when you listened to that the first time, did you hear anything that was interesting?
A lot of clicks. I thought I heard clicks.
Okay, those aren't too interesting, but... So let me play it once more. No, those are actually, the clicks and things sometimes can tell you how the information was recorded.
Suratan na kiti Lizardfish Talo at Yahoo.com may panggap ti amin ngay bagala iti tarib ng awag at Lizardfish
Talo. Is it Yiddish?
Time. Is it Yiddish?
Is it Turkish? From like Turkish? Southeastern Asia?
Kenyan?
What continent is it on?
Alright, one more time. Listen about one third of the way into the utter. Into
did
the
say
utterance.
Fish?
Close. Good. Okay, I think that's.
Fish, where?
That might win you a prize.
Okay, prize.
Listen once more.
Suratan na kiti lizard fish talo at yahoo at ka may panggap ti amin ng bagay
sa
rin ng awag trisin at at
so this is, you're basically now doing what people do for a living when they work for the military, this process of intelligence. Now, fortunately, they have people who speak the native language who can help them. But oftentimes, all that will you'll be exposed to one of these cuts with very little context. For example, when immediately after 9/11, one of the stories about one of the more famous stories about how important language became, the New York Police Department was swamped with calls from citizens who came home one day and found recordings like this on their answering machines, and were afraid that that might be some terrorists who called the wrong number and left a message that something was going to happen. In fact, if you listen to this, we'll analyze this message a little bit more. But so what they did was they took their tape recording down to the local police station and said, "I'm scared. What's going on here? Do something with this." Well, the local police stations were not equipped to handle this because they didn't even know what languages these were. So the first question you have to ask is, well, what language is that? And then maybe you can figure out who you're going to need to call about that language. So all of this basically filtered up, but this was happening all over the country in the days immediately following 9/11, and people were really worried that maybe there was important information on these tapes. So what I want to do today is to discuss the algorithms that we actually use to do some analysis of this information by machine. We'll talk about language ID and talk about this problem of how you actually decipher what language it is using a computer program. But the other interesting thing about this message, I'll play it one more time, so, and listen for the word lizardfish, and then listen right after that. Because another thing about the way the world has changed is how the internet now helps us to do this kind of thing.
Suratan na kiti lizardfish talo at yahoo at ka may panggap ti amin ngay bagada iti tarip ng awag trisin at at.
You heard what?
Hamburger.
No. There's no hamburger. I was thinking we should do something like that with the title, but no, there's no hamburger in this utterance. Nobody heard that?
Listen,
listen right after lizardfish. There's a very important piece of information on this.
Is it like talon?
Can I answer?
No. You know, I think she had to sit at home while I was playing this over and over trying to.
Suratan na kiti lizardfish talo at yahoo at ka may panggap ti amin ngay bagada iti tarip ng awag trisin at at.
I heard 11.
Well, maybe I'm in the wrong, maybe you don't have a future in the intelligence business. There's a very important piece of information in that utterance. Now, what? Now, another interesting thing, the fact that you didn't understand a lot of this is good, because when I show you what was actually said, and now then you listen to it, you'll be able to understand a lot more. And that's another interesting thing about this. When you know what you're supposed to listen for, you can decipher a lot more from this kind of thing. But when you're just listening to random cuts, for example, browsing the internet or something, it's much harder. So a little bit more about the world's languages, and then we'll come back to that cut. There are over 6,000 known languages in the world. A number of these languages are vanishing. Latin's a good example. We don't really speak Latin on an everyday basis. But the internet and the way the world is kind of evolving actually means a number of these languages are dying, and there are some initiatives to try to preserve these languages on the internet. I've linked to some resources on that if you want to know something more about it. So some people were saying, well, everyone's going to speak English. The world is converging on a small number of languages. But that's actually not true. From a linguistic point of view, the world's becoming more diverse because more and more people are communicating in their native languages over the internet or in traveling around the world and such. So the world is, the need to know many more than a handful of languages has become very important. And then the dominance of English is being challenged. Also, if you look at this from a public school point of view, even in Mississippi, which we all know is kind of a fairly homogeneous population, There's about 12 languages that cover 99% of the population, and about 3.6% of the people speak a language other than English. In the Chicago public school system, there's about 100 languages represented. And this is a problem public schools are not prepared to deal with, is how do you deal with all these different languages? Common languages are used to facilitate communication, but we also have to remember language historically evolved as a way to carry on covert communications. If you've ever wondered why two countries would share a boundary, speak completely different languages, that was not by accident. Oftentimes, farmers from one country didn't want the farmers from the other country to know what they were talking about. So languages actually sort of evolved as a way that people could communicate covertly people who are geographically close. So even though there's this tendency to people to think that the language problem is going away with the internet and as more and more people converse, in fact, today we find the need to for companies to deal with and the government to deal with many, many different languages. If you look, for example, at the bottom of Google's, a simple web page like Google, they support about 100 languages now. So, you know, it's a very interesting kind of bipolar type situation. Now, one of my favorite quotes about the problem that the government intelligence industry faces is there are 6.7 billion people in the world that represent over 6,000 languages. About 300 million of these are Americans. Who worries about the other 6.4 billion? When something happens in the world, the president expects to be able to pick up a phone and call somebody and find out what's happening. Now, if you think about that from the U.S. point of view, to be able to manage our daily affairs throughout the world, we have to literally monitor what's going on in the rest of the world. That's a very daunting task. And yet, think about it, when you see something happen and you're watching it on CNN, if somebody, you know, somebody did some act of terrorism somewhere in the world, you expect to know something about that almost immediately. Well, that's very difficult when there are many, many languages involved. For example, one of the areas in the world that's become rather dangerous is the Philippines. I don't know if you remember the Betancourt and a few of her colleagues who were, there's a number of terrorist activities where people from these very fringe groups are abducting people and that kind of thing. You have the Somali pirates going on right now off the coast of Somalia. And in the Philippines alone, 170 languages are spoken. Now, this clip that I played for you, this is actually one of the more
suratan na kitila sir fish talo at yakon at kamay pangbirte amin ngay bagalit sa rin kang awang.
This particular passage is a language called Ilocano, which is the third most common language in the Philippines. And this particular message, the thing I was trying to get you to hear is you'll notice they say lizardfish at yahoo.com.
They said three in Ilocano.
I'm sorry?
They said three in their language, right?
Yeah, I think the three was in their language. Just with this lizardfish yahoo.com, that gives us the ability now to go out on the internet and start figuring out more about who this person is and what they're talking about. In English, a rough translation of this is that they're saying, send everything they said at the meeting to Lizardfish and I'll call him immediately. That's sort of an important, if you have some context for this, more than likely that's an important statement. That means you might want to learn a little bit more about what's going on. But imagine trying to do that in 6,000 languages across 6 billion people. And you say, well, that's impossible, but yet our politicians have an expectation that the military agencies have the capability to do this. So one of the ways that you deal with this problem, and what I want to spend most of the time talking about tonight, is we can automate the extraction of information from text messages and voice messages using some of the things that I'll talk about tonight, language identification. We can use that to decipher this language. And then social networking, I'll talk a little bit about that. We can take this email address, lizardfish@yahoo.com, and thanks to the fact that many of you live on Facebook and you have these networks that describe all your friends and all this great stuff, we can figure out a lot about you. And if you don't think people are doing that, there are people doing that for both commercial and military interests. even sites like Google that are very popular collect massive amounts of information on what you're doing on the internet, and I'll talk a little bit about that. So when we deal with voice data such as this, one of the things we first have to do, there's a hierarchy of things that we do. The very first step is often we have to figure out what language it is, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. There's a lot of other things we can do beyond that, but I'll focus mainly on the language identification problem today. So what we need to do is to build a machine that can determine what language was being spoken. And the way that we do this today is using a technique or a technology known as statistical machine learning. And in a very broad sense, statistical machine learning is, it's a really very simple concept where you train a computer to recognize language by feeding it lots of data from those languages and letting it automatically learn the characteristic of those languages. So the basic way that we do this, whether we're talking about language ID, whether we're talking about natural language processing, speech recognition, all the technologies use the same basic setup where on the development side, we collect a lot of data, we choose features for the data, we choose some kind of statistical model, and then we go through an algorithm that takes all that data and optimizes the parameters of that model so that that model can predict that kind of data. And then we take that system and put it in operation and sort of do the reverse. We take the new data, we measure it against the existing models, and we choose the language that was most probable according to those models. So this basic approach is what's dominated most of the algorithm side of computer science and engineering over the past 20 years. And we use this across a wide range of technologies. And one of the things I really like about the program here is you get a very good opportunity to learn a lot about statistics in the program here. And statistics are a very, very important part of what we do in most fields of engineering these days. But there are some challenges associated with this. One of the more serious is that we need lots of data from these 6,000 languages if we're going to be able to train these kinds of models. Well, when 9/11 first broke out, we did not have a lot of Arabic data. And the last thing you want to do is to go into countries like Iran with a microphone and say, "Hi, I'm from the US government. I'd like to record your voice so that I can train algorithms to recognize your speech so that I can do intelligence on you." That usually gets you shot in countries like that. But that's actually literally the problem that we face. We had no native speakers of many of these languages that we were interested in. And getting this kind of data is not a trivial thing when you're dealing with a language that's not spoken very much in the world. Now, in this process of doing this kind of machine learning, there's three key steps here. There's the features, there's the model, and there's a classifier. And I want to talk a little bit about each one of those. The approach for converting the signal to a sequence of vectors, that's essentially what we need to do if we're going to apply these algorithms. And for audio signals, we use a technique where we take the speech signal, we convert it to a frequency representation, we look at energy as a function of frequency, and then we do some analysis on those frequencies, and we take the spectrum, we differentiate it, you all know what that is from your calculus, and we actually take the second derivative, and we put these three pieces of information together into a vector that we measure about 100 times a second, and that sequence of vectors then goes into our subsequent software to do this kind of pattern recognition. This feature analysis is used across most audio applications, whether we're talking about language ID, speech recognition, speaker recognition, or those kinds of, you know, any of those kinds of technologies. Now, once we do that, we then try to model the data. And voice is very interesting because when you're speaking, you generally are trying to follow some basic rules of grammar. And we can apply those rules of grammar to model the sequences of sounds that you're likely to speak. And then we can take each one of those sounds and we model them actually with a graph or a state machine that looks something like this. It has these states associated with it, and at each one of those states we use a group of Gaussian or normal distributions. Now, I think some of you should know a little bit about what that means. And when you have a Gaussian or a normal distribution, there's two key parameters. There's the mean and the variance, right?
Yeah.
And we actually deal with what are called multivariate Gaussian distributions. We use multiple dimensions, not just one dimension. But what we do in these training algorithms is we optimize or we train the means and the variances of these distributions to match the characteristics of your speech sounds. And then we combine that with some grammar knowledge, some knowledge about the fact that certain sounds have to occur in certain sequences. And we build all that into a machine that then can analyze incoming speech and make decisions about what kind of sounds were spoken. So once we have those models, then we can actually go to do into the process of how do we do language identification. Well, language identification is kind of interesting because we've all played the game, like we did at the beginning of this talk, of what language is it? Well, it sounds like it might be Arabic. Well, why do you think it sounded like Arabic?
Stereotypes.
What?
Stereotypes.
Well, so that's what we call a priori knowledge. You have some notions in your head about what Arabic sounds like, and often those notions are formed out of things like the distribution of consonants and vowels in the language. We try to encode that information into these systems, but we do that in a statistical sense. We try to let the computer learn the differences between Arabic, English, Japanese, and so forth. Now, but another thing, interesting thing about language ID is that in addition to the way the language sounds, the types of words you speak or the types of sounds you make in the language can be very important in determining a type of language. One of the most unique sounding languages, for English speakers at least, are the African languages that fall in the category of languages called click languages. You may have seen some of these. I can't even attempt to pronounce some of these languages, but these languages, you hear those clicks and you say, oh, that must be one of these African languages. That was not a click language.
That one guy there's a person at our school that can speak.
Yeah. It's a completely, the way they move their articulators, completely different, and we're not trained to articulate in that way. But a language like that has a very different statistical property than a language like English. So what we do is we collect data from a lot of different languages, we build these models, and then we simply reverse the process and we take an incoming utterance like this one, we convert it into features, and then we apply those features to a classifier which really does nothing more than computes the probability of that data given each one of these models. So if we want to measure against 6,000 languages, we have to have 6,000 models of those languages stored in our system. And we do that using actually a product of probabilities. We compute the probability of the data, the vectors given the language, and then we also compute the a priori probability of the language. So when you said, well, I think it might be Arabic because of the stereotype, well, we actually do that. We know that in certain domains, certain languages are more common than other languages, and we actually can encode that into this model. And then the classifier itself, there's a number of ways we implement that. I don't know if you've been exposed yet to things like neural networks, but they've been very popular for a number of years. We also use a newer technology called support vector machines. These are all different kinds of things you will study if you get very deep into statistics, but they all serve the same purpose of simply trying to make a decision on what was the most probable language. We can look at performance as a function of the amount of data. If I have access to 40 hours of data, I can get fairly good performance in using this kind of technology. But it's actually very difficult to get access to this amount of data in many, many languages. So very often we're asked to do this task where we have only a few hours of data. And this is a very important curve because this is a general property of most statistical systems, is that the more data you give them, the better they can learn to recognize or to classify. And collecting of the data then becomes a major task in itself. And there are organizations that are using the internet to collect tens of thousands of hours of data in each of the world's 6,000 languages, and then we can use that data to actually train these systems. And fortunately, because you're also generous in donating your voice to YouTube and MySpace and all these things, there are people who are pulling that data down and using it to build these kinds of models. So, you know.
What's 3L and 4L?
What?
What are the two curves in that graph?
What are the two curves? The difference between these curves is actually the upper curve is when we look at only three languages. The lower curve is when we look at four languages. Performance in general actually goes down with the number of languages that we're comparing against. So usually when we do language ID, we don't try to compare against all 6,000 languages. We try to figure out what are the small set of probable languages for that application space, and then we focus on those. Because in general, performance will degrade. So if you tried to compare against 6,000 languages, your performance would probably be about 10% accuracy, yeah, which is not very good. But if we keep it down to a list of several well-known languages, we can get pretty good performance. So that's a very good observation. Yes?
What would cause a sudden increase in like the first few hours, but then nowhere near as much in later hours?
Well, we have a famous saying in our field. No data like more data. So the models that we're using in this system have literally millions of variables. Now, if you think about maybe an analogy to this might be your physics lab when you're collecting data and you're trying to draw a line through the data. When you collect one or two or three points, you get a pretty rough line and the points are all over the place and you're not sure where the line's supposed to go. But as you get maybe 10 or 20 or 30 points, it becomes clearer where the line should go. It's the same principle here. If you have a system with 1 million parameters, you're going to need tens of thousands of hours of data to accurately estimate those parameters. So we get a very dramatic increase in performance with the first few hours of data because the system's performing very poorly. We actually, you'll notice, even after 40 hours of data, these curves have not flattened. Those curves will continue to rise if I run out to hundreds and thousands of hours of data. Okay, so I think my second question, I'm running out of questions here since you didn't see my movie. So my second question is going to be, when you're browsing the internet with Google, you'll notice in the lower left-hand portion of your screen, sometimes you'll see a URL pop up called Google Analytics. Does anybody have an idea what they're doing?
They track your IP and all the information about you. They store it, and they don't give it to the government.
Very good. So you get the
chocolate bar.
We've got chocolate, more chocolate, and popcorn.
Orville!
I thought the popcorn would go first, because that's pretty. So that's very good. So you don't ever think when you're browsing the internet that people aren't watching what you're doing. My second question is going to be, how come when I do a Google search and advertisements pop up for me, how come they're different than the advertisements that pop up for my daughter?
They do that on Facebook. Like, they'll look into your interest and they'll pop up with stuff that they know you like. So you want
right,
to
so she gets it. All the cool stuff and I get like the old people stuff. So why is that?
Because they know like your interest. They know what would target you.
Okay, but Facebook has an advantage because you gladly tell them all about yourself. But even when you do this outside of Facebook, it's done. Why?
They find your interest through the sites that you visit.
So where are they getting this information?
Cookies.
Tracking your information. Very good, very good. Which one?
Image.
My personal favorite.
They knew it was fish.
No, it's okay. I'm just kidding. I have coffee
cans. Yeah, I think we should actually award. Who was the first one to get fish on that? That was you, right? So I think we should.
Thank you.
So analytics. This is a whole new world. This is a whole new business. This is one of the fastest growing businesses on the internet. A formal definition, this is such a new concept that there actually isn't an agreed upon formal definition. But if you look on Wikipedia, it's a tool or a process that allows an entity to arrive at an optimal or realistic decision based on existing data. What that means in plain terms is that advertisers are paying good money for people to tell them what you're doing on the internet. which means someone must be figuring out what you're doing on the internet, which means whether you like it or not, it's not just the intelligence community that's doing intelligence on, and intelligence community actually doesn't worry about you, they worry about the rest of the world. But all the websites are basically tracking information about you. And they use this information to produce analytics like what we're showing on the right. This is actually a service that Google provides where they will give you a complete, a very thorough analysis of who's using your site, where these people live, and a lot of other information about their preferences and purchases and things.
Creepy.
And Google is one of the leading companies in this. They're building a highly profitable business around this, what are called analytics. Anytime you access a web page, you're absolutely right. You're leaving all sorts of information about what you're doing. This allows advertisers to tailor their ads to your personal interests. If you've ever seen AdMeter pop up or any of these kinds of sites, this is one of the fastest growing businesses on the internet. All the websites basically do this now. And of course, the things I really like are sites like Amazon and Netflix. You buy something on Amazon, what's the first thing they do?
Email you.
No, even before that.
You might also like this.
You might also like to buy these other things, right? Very, very effective. Netflix. I love Netflix when Netflix first came online. Did anyone, are any of you Netflix customers?
Yeah.
Did you enroll and do your little movie rankings and all that?
Mm-hmm.
And how accurate were the choices they were coming up with?
Pretty good.
Pretty good, right?
Yeah.
So the movie industry got on this fairly quickly. The latest thing I've enjoyed playing with, which I just started a few months ago, is Pandora.com. How many of you are using Pandora? Pretty cool, right?
Yeah.
What?
Is that the Music Genome?
It's part of the Music Genome Project. Yeah. In fact, I'd love to come and do a talk just on what Pandora does. There's a lot of interesting technology there. But the other interesting thing about all this is that you're all now carrying phones that are GPS enabled. So, the movie The Conversation in the 70s that used to talk, it's based around this concept that the government's watching us and that's really bad. Guess what? More than ever, the government's watching you. Not so much the government, but everybody's watching you. And with your GPS phones now, especially when you're browsing the internet from your GPS phone, not only do they know what you're looking at, but they know where you are.
Creepy.
So they can do a lot of useful things, like tell you there's a really good French restaurant just down the road. That if you're interested in French restaurants, you should go eat there.
It doesn't. I don't know about any of the companies, but I was reading earlier this year that the government was trying to get Google to submit all its privacy information.
Yes, that was a big.
And they wouldn't. They refused to do that.
That was a big, big legal challenge. In fact, just today, I was reading an article. I was going to bring up a screenshot of this. Just today, it was revealed that the Chinese government has access to information on Skype in China. I don't know if you're familiar with Skype. Is a
the microphone talking
right
thingy.
And Chinese government has been monitoring. They're portraying it as though the Chinese government hacked into the Skype system in China. There's some question about whether that was an agreement Skype had to make to get into the country or whether this was done maliciously. But either way, the government has been able to access all the information about the users in Skype and using that to do intelligence. The internet companies have been resisting the government's efforts to get access to their data. And it's a very complicated issue. As with any issue like that, I would encourage you not to believe everything you read in the press, but if you really want to learn about the issue, spend some time studying it, because there's many, many sides to these kinds of issues. But the fact is, there's a lot of information about you already flowing around the internet for free. And and I don't know if you noticed, if you've been following browsers, but the next release of browsers is going to offer you this anonymous browsing capability as one way to combat this. It's one of the features that you'll see in the next generation of all the major browsers.
Safari does it already, I think.
Yeah, I think Safari might. And I think the new version of Internet Explorer is supposed to allow this as well.
The beta of 8 has it, and so does Chrome.
But these are not truly, I mean, they've done what they can, but they're not truly anonymous. You can
You can only use a proxy.
Yeah,
I think that
right. So we had that phone call. We now have the technology to figure out what language it is. That tells us a lot. But in that phone call, they said lizardfish@yahoo.com. Well, 10 years ago, that wouldn't tell us much. We wouldn't really be able to do much with that information. But the other big revolution that's going on, thanks to many of you, is social networking. It is so nice of you that you go out there and you tell us who all your friends are and you build your little networks and you encode all sorts of information, because people are turning that into a business, into intelligence, into other things. And there's real questions about whether these companies should allow other companies to access the data that they're collecting on you. But certainly by monitoring what sites and people you visit and how frequently you visit them, you can build a graph, and that's called a social network of the people that and sites that you're interacting with. These graphs can be aggregated or averaged to understand group dynamics. You can look at a profile of a business, what types of users that they're catering to. But for the intelligence side of things, we can take the language of that cut, we can take the email address of that cut, we can go into Facebooks and MySpaces and look for that email address, we can look at other things like the IP address, the location of that IP address, and before you know it, even though the world is 6 billion people, you can actually start to focus in on very specific individuals, because the intersections of all this kind of information, there's only a few people in the world that fit that profile. And this is essentially how the government can actually find people in a fairly efficient way.
Is there any way that the government can issue a warrant for a specific email to force Yahoo to live?
Yeah, so another major revolution that's gone on is they have very recently revised what's called the Foreign Intelligence Act, FISA, that sort of the laws about how the government can do surveillance. And this is a very complicated issue, because the U.S. in particular is very theoretically very protective of your privacy, and they do not allow anybody to eavesdrop on your phone calls and your emails and things. But on the other hand, when a world event happens, all of a sudden they're magically some company is turning over a lot of this information. So it's a very complicated issue. But I think the thing you have to be respectful of is the fact that that information exists on many different computers around the country, and no matter how hard the government tries, they cannot often prevent other people getting access to that information. In some countries, the governments are allowed to freely access that kind of information. So graph theory plays a very prominent role in this kind of thing. I don't know, I was looking for a picture. One of my favorite scenes is the scene in the X-Men where he's able to go into his little room and see all the X-people or whatever they're called, all the mutants. That's actually computable with the kind of compute power we have today, and the fact that you're all carrying around GPS-enabled phones. So this is creating a whole new world, or a whole new set of opportunities for how we do business, because not only do we know what you're doing, but we know where you're doing it. And it's interesting how sophisticated the technology has gotten, that when you deviate from your habitual behavior, systems can detect that very quickly. I've been very impressed. There have been a lot of credit card hacking. My credit card company will routinely call me after one purchase is made that doesn't fit my typical profile of purchases. I hope you don't have too many credit cards right now, but you will experience this very soon. Credit card companies build profiles of your purchasing behavior, and as a way to prevent credit card fraud, the minute there's one or two transactions that don't fit that behavior, they have a system which automatically triggers and tells them that, and then they will give you a phone call and they will stop your credit card and things as a protective measure. So even though there's 6 billion people in the world, and people like to think that they're very creative and very random, people are tremendously habitual in their behavior, and that makes it very easy with computer programs to figure out when you're doing something that's much different than what you've done before. And that is a very important skill if you're in the business of trying to understand what people are doing. Now, at the bottom of all of this, we use a very simple mathematical model. So, for example, if we want to figure out something about your purchasing behavior, we can take all of the websites that you visit, we can classify them according to whether they're retail-oriented, maybe information-oriented, and then we can actually build a linear model that tries to discriminate between those two groups so that we can figure out if you're the type of customer who likes to go onto retail sites or if you're the type of customer that likes to read newspapers. That same model is what we use in language ID, speech recognition, and many other things. And even though it's a simple model, we can actually train that model on the statistics we collect from all these sites that you're visiting and things like that. So the model can become very powerful because it's tailored to your specific behaviors. And this is sort of statistic, from a statistical point of view, this is essentially what we do, is we do nothing more than we take this model and we try to figure out those weights W that best fit your behavior for particular types of things that you do. For example, even within a domain like what websites you visit, you know, obviously if you're visiting Al Jazeera, the government might be a little more interested in that than if you're visiting the MSMS website. And there are technologies that train up models to do that kind of thing, so that when something happens, military, for example, will go to these websites from these foreign countries and try to figure out what's being talked about on these websites. And there are different ways that we can do this, but the state of the art today involves using a group of models that are called Bayesian models, which mix a priori information, what sites you're likely to visit, and actual information, what sites you have visited. And as you get further into your studies of statistics, you'll learn a lot more about Bayesian methods. Now, predicting users' preferences, this is a very big business today. These models, once they're trained, can actually be used to generate your preferences. So how does Netflix suggest movies? Well, they look at all the movies you like, all the movies you've rented, and then they build a model of that, and then they run that model to generate choices. Now, there's two ways that's done. One is you can use a predictive statistical model, or the other thing you can do is you can actually relate movies to one another and say, well, if you rent this movie, the public, if you look across the public, you say, well, people who rent this movie have a tendency to rent these other movies, so let me recommend those movies as an alternate choice. That's done with what we call link grammars, and that's one way that these sites do these alternate choices. They interrelate all the different products that they sell so that when you select one, they know what other products are in the proximity of that product. But a more interesting way to do it is to actually build a statistical model of your purchasing behavior and then to run that model and let it generate choices automatically. Now, sites like Pandora are taking this one step further, and they allow you to continuously rate choices, and then they adapt those models every time you make a choice. This is a area of science we call adaptive systems, and that's also done using statistics. But this is a very hot area within the community, the ability of systems to adapt in real time to your behavior. So that every time you make a choice on Pandora, it's updating its model and then feeding you new choices based on all your choices, but including your most recent choices. Now, the other big emerging area is what's called content-based searching. I won't talk about this too much tonight, but I don't know if you remember, about a couple months ago, a new website was unveiled, got a lot of publicity on CNN called CUIL. It's a content-based search site. And what this site does is it tries to let you actually search pages for content. So what I did in preparation for this talk, I went out on a few of the sites like ask.com and I think this is cool.
That's cool. It says on the top.
Cool, right? I think it's cool. And I also looked through Dogpile and a few of the others, but I asked the question, who is the Chicago Bears quarterback? And what these search engines are trying to do is not just let you find matches, but they're actually trying to answer questions for you. So that's sort of the next step with the internet, is because if you've done Google searching lately, you may observe that the network's become so big that a lot of the searches, the matches Google returns, are not very useful. What people are trying to do now is to build technology which will actually answer questions and give you the specific information you're looking for. Well, none of these sites did very well on that question, and I thought that was actually interesting. I thought they would do better. But they do this because underneath, they've actually analyzed and indexed all this information that they've collected. They actually take web pages and transform them into meaning representations so that when you ask a question, they can then look at the meaning of that information and provide you the information that matches at a meaning level, rather than just looking at what keywords and search terms match. So that's about it. We've talked a little bit about technologies that integrate information to understand and accommodate its users. We've talked about some of the core components of these technologies and the math and statistical models behind them. And we've talked about the fact that GPS and things like that are creating a whole new version of the internet that not only combines sort of information that exists on the internet, but it combines things like where you are and what you're doing. And that's going to generate a whole new generation of applications. I don't know if any of you have iPhones. Have you played with some of the new applications on the iPhones? There's a whole community now developing some applications for the iPhone based on the fact that they can use the GPS information. Do you have any particular...
I just got started. I still have the old version.
Yeah.
So
with iPhones, you can do things like, you know, show me the closest restaurant that has the type of food I like, and that kind of thing. And the thing to remember with all of this is that behind the scenes, there are companies mining all of this data so that they can provide value to other companies in better, you know, we'd like to view it in a positive sense. They're trying to better serve you, but...
They're
what?
They're kind of stalking you.
They are kind of stalking you.
They are stalking you.
So with that, I will conclude the talk and answer any questions or help you enjoy some pizza.
Charnel, you got a door prize.
Yay!
Good job. Congrats.
So what, she got both of the questions right?
She got one of them.
One of them right.
Nobody got the second one.
No one got the second one? Are you going to solve? Do I get to see the answer to the second one?
Wait, you need more time, man.
If oh, yeah, you better collect it first.
Go ahead and give it to Alex.
Jack.
And,